debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The piece that I wrote for tomhartman.medium.com is titled, There's a Nefarious Plot Underway Around the State of the Union Address. I find this absolutely fascinating. There are all these Republicans who are tweeting and they're on Facebook and they're ranting on right-wing talk radio about how Joe Biden has not held a State of the Union Address. The State of the Union Address is typically in the first week or two of February, and, it's kind of a tradition. It dates back to the 1930s. Franklin Roosevelt started doing them fairly regularly. Before that, it was kind of hit and miss. The Constitution doesn't say that the president shall give a State of the Union Address. It says, from time to time, the president shall basically report to Congress. I'm doing this from memory rather than reading it from the Constitution, but this is the essence of it, that the president shall periodically report to Congress on the State of the Union. And FDR turned that into kind of a PR thing, you know, as a way of pushing the New Deal. And every president since then has largely done that. And Biden's a little behind on this. So David Badasch over at the New Civil Rights Movement compiled a whole list of all these tweets and things of all these people who are, you know, trying to get, saying, you know, we need to have a State of the Union address. So we want the, now, why did the right wingers want to hear from Joe Biden? I mean, just think about that for a minute. Why are all of a sudden all these right wingers demanding that every single member of the House of Representatives, every single member of the United States Senate, the Vice President and the President, all to get together in one room and listen to a speech by the President? Why would they do that? Why is this such a big issue? Why is it that right-wing talk radio is talking about it nonstop? USA Today, I mean, it's gotten so wild that USA Today, the national newspaper, published a fact check explaining that no, there's no constitutional requirement for the president to do a State of the Union speech. Thomas Jefferson used to hand them in writing. He was bashful. I mean, literally, he was a very shy person, and he didn't like to speak in public, let's say. And this is crazy. Why is this? And there's a lot of people have been scratching their heads for about a week now, maybe a week and a half, since this noise really started about, we want a State of the Union. And then the acting head of the Capitol Police, Yogananda Pittman, said this in sworn testimony before Congress, quote, we know that members of the militia groups that were present on January 6th have stated their desires that they want to blow up the Capitol and kill as many members of Congress as possible with a direct nexus to the State of the Union. End quote. Oh my God. You know, the Confederacy that declared war against America in 1861 was all about using violence to enforce white supremacy. To this day, white supremacists fight any attempts, these white supremacist Republican politicians fight any attempts to improve the lives of even the poorest of Americans. They oppose the minimum wage, they oppose expanding Medicaid, they oppose expanding food stamps, basically anything, all because some of those programs, all of those programs, might in some way benefit black people. I just sent off the manuscript on my next book in the Hidden History series, The Hidden History of American Healthcare. And, you know, I spent the last year researching this book, and what I found was that literally every single time from the late 1800s until the passage of Medicare in 1965, when various American presidents or high-profile American politicians tried to establish a national single-payer healthcare system in the United States or any variation thereof, it was opposed by white Southern, largely Southern, not always, but white racist so-called conservative politicians who, up until 1965, actually bragged about the fact that they were opposing it because they didn't want black people to get any of those benefits. In the first book in the Hidden History series, The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment, I laid out how the Second Amendment was written the way it was at the time it was to protect the slave patrols in Virginia and South Carolina, and how today's gun culture, in quotes, is rooted in white rage and white fear. I point out in the Hidden History of the War on Voting how from the 19th century forward they've been using voter suppression techniques to block the black vote. And that's why, you know, we have several hundred pieces of legislation now introduced in state legislatures to make, in over 30 states, to make it harder for people to vote. So, you know, it shouldn't be any coincidence that the people who attacked the Capitol, in addition to having T-shirts that say 6 million wasn't enough and you know, other Nazi memorabilia, also were carrying Confederate flags. I think, by and large, Americans have figured this out, that the Trump MAGA movement pretty much begins and ends with white supremacy. There's a festival of white supremacy this weekend at CPAC in Washington, D.C. From their Build the Wall to putting brown children in cages, to the Kung Flu slur, to the Muslim ban, virtually everything Donald Trump has done or pushed flows back to trashing people who are not white. And his one legislative achievement, I mean, literally, only he, in 4 years, he accomplished one thing. $1.5 trillion tax cut, 83% of the benefit went to rich, mostly white people. Meanwhile, the black police officers in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, there's a great story about it yesterday in the New York Times, talked about how they were beaten, spit upon, and called racial slurs, constantly being called the N-word by people in this, you know, pro-Trump MAGA crowd. Why? Because that crowd was trying to end American democracy and replace it with strongman white supremacist rule. You know, this ideology, this belief that only white people should hold power or wealth in the United States has been at the core of the so-called conservative movement since the founding of this republic. And it continues to be the primary value of the mostly white Republican Party. Look at the judicial nominees that came out of the Trump administration. There might have been one person of color. You know, look at his cabinet. One person of color. I mean, what these guys are trying to do is continue the work that Tim McVeigh started. I mean, it started long before him, but in the modern era. And I think there's a direct line from Tim McVeigh to the siege in the Capitol. This is the third time that oligarchs, white supremacist oligarchs in America, have tried to overthrow our republic. The first time was in 1861 when they declared war on us. We beat them back. The second time was in 1933. When they tried to assassinate Franklin Roosevelt, the businessman's conspiracy, Google it if you're not familiar with it. Smedley Butler blew that up on them. Those were 80 years apart. The first was 80 years after the founding of the Republic. The second was 80 years after the Civil War. And here we are now, 80 years after FDR's death, and they're trying to do it all over again. I am really concerned that if the few remaining Republicans of good conscience, the Mitt Romneys of the Republican Party, don't start speaking out loudly especially now that Mitch McConnell went on Fox News and said, yes, I'd support Donald Trump. Absolutely support him for president in 2024. If they don't start speaking out loudly, this little window in time and history for the Republican Party to return to some semblance of sanity that it had during the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower, that window is closing fast. And once it's gone, it's going to be, you know, the Democratic Party basically represents American values right across the spectrum, and the Republican Party is a white supremacist, neo-fascist party. And where does that take our country?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here. Also, somebody on Twitter pointed out that blowing up Congress and killing everybody except for the one member of Congress who is at every State of the Union address spirited away and stashed in an underground bunker just in case is the premise, is the plot premise of this TV show, Designated Survivor, which Louise and I've watched, like, I think the first year and a half of. And, you know, it hadn't occurred to me this morning when I was writing this piece that all these Republicans all of a sudden are demanding a State of the Union address. And then the acting chief of the Capitol Police comes out and says, yeah, they want to blow up the Capitol during the State of the Union. And typically, State of the Unions aren't even held in the first year. Trump had his first State of the Union address in 2018. So what the hell is going on here? People watching too much TV? I don't know. Anyhow, Kenyatta in Los Angeles. Hey, Kenyatta, what's on your mind today?
Mr. Hartman, I know that you've covered this and you are well aware, given your stellar intellect, that there is a congressional hearing being conducted with regards to the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Now, I have been bothered for the almost 2 months since that event with something that I don't know why it's not the most prominent thing on everyone's mind, and that's this. As I watch those people climbing those walls and having some training and background in law enforcement, there's something that you spend about a week on or two called riot control, and there's certain deployments as the situation escalates. I saw none of that, Tom. I saw these people, and I'm sure you probably saw this, there's a video of a black police officer in the Capitol actually moving up the stairs backwards in retreat while this mob comes after him, and he's basically in absolute fear. There was absolutely none of the aggression that I saw in Los Angeles in 1992 and in other places around the country in the last year. I am astounded because I keep asking myself, and let me cut to the chase here. I'm calling you for a sanity check, Tom, because I'm wondering, I cannot get my arms around the fact that if these people were black people or people that looked like me climbing those walls, attacking those officers, that the outcome would have been the same. I did not see any CS gas, meaning chemical shield gas, being deployed by other than the assailants. I saw these cops actually in retreat mode. I didn't see any baton strikes. Within hours of the 1992 riots in Los Angeles, we had the National Guard on the street with truck-mounted machine guns. Am I missing something here, Mr. Hartman?
No. and you know it well, Kenyatta. The response can be murderous. When white people behave poorly, the response is largely to ignore it, give them a pass, let it go. I mean, you know, this is the history of America, and it's continuing in a big way. And yes, if the people attacking the Capitol on January 6th had been black, the response would have been entirely different. And if the rally, in fact, had been mostly black people, there would have been, I mean, there was a Black Lives Matter rally in Washington, D.C. just a few weeks before that, maybe a month before that, I don't recall the exact date, where the National Guard was out in force. And you know, and it was just a rally. And there was no violence at all. And so I, Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Kenyatta. And I think that this was something that the Donald Trump and his criminal co-conspirators planned. I think it was planned in advance. I think the final preparations were laid on January 5th in this meeting in the Trump Hotel that apparently Senator Tuberville was in. I think that he should be questioned about this. I think it's kind of bizarre that the House and Senate are investigating something that members of the House and Senate apparently participated in, giving tours to these insurrectionists in advance, these white supremacists in advance. And I am hoping, and I don't want to see a 9/11 style commission that whitewashes this the way they whitewashed 9/11 and the way that they whitewashed the Kennedy assassination. You know, they kind of bleached Saudi involvement out of the 9/11 thing, and they bleached mafia involvement out of the Kennedy killing. And I just, you know, I think that what we need is some serious badass prosecutors with a grand jury or two going after this and going after people in power and hauling the people who were in that meeting in the Trump Hotel the night before before a grand jury and questioning them under oath and nailing them if they lie. There is something really evil going on here, Kenyatta, and it's grounded in white supremacy, the ideology of white supremacy, and the ongoing maintenance which the GOP has advocated since 65, and which the Democratic Party advocated before 65, of maintaining white power and white wealth as the principal pillar of America. And it's got to end, because there's so much talent being destroyed or never having an opportunity to express itself. I mean, you know, quick, name a black billionaire. There's 670, I think, billionaires in the United States. There's seven of them who are black. Black people are 14.5% of the U.S. population. They're not 14.5% of the billionaires or even the multimillionaires or even the politicians or the people in power in any position. There is a reason for that. It's you know, 400 years of white supremacy and racism.
Well, Tom.
Okay, back to you.
There's some areas. Well, there's some areas where we do rank first now. We do rank first in incarceration. We rank first in every negative health outcome in whatever disease there is. So now don't give us short.
You are making my point, sir.
Yes. But I do want to say to you real quick, you know, one of the interesting things, you mentioned Donald Trump and his advance notice, and it was really interesting to watch the spin on the legal arguments during the impeachment from the Republicans. They were saying, well, these people had planted pipe bombs and these people, you know, had equipment. And so obviously this was not a result of his rally speech, but it was planned before. But what they don't understand, that everybody's not stupid enough to understand this, he already knew before. That's why he did what he did. And let me tell you something. Before Donald Trump spoke, his son spoke. If you haven't seen that speech, you need to hear that speech. Right before Donald Trump at that rally on January 6th spoke, his son spoke. Last point I want to make is this, Tom, with regards to that Capitol insurrection and the oddity, and thank you for the sanity check of it, every day we're finding more and more police officers were not only aiding and abetting it that were with the Capitol Police and the D.C. police, but also police officers in the crowd.
Right. They're up to 65 now that they've pulled off duty and are in the process of investigating. And that's very troubling. I mean, the infiltration of police departments and of the military. Mikey Weinstein blew the whistle on this with regard to the Air Force Academy 15 years ago. I had him on this program because his son was in the Air Force Academy, and his son wasn't even, you know, black. He was Jewish. But he was being discriminated against, essentially, and harassed because he was Jewish. I mean, it's not just, you know, white. It's white fundamentalist Christianity, but it's mostly white. This is a cancer. And it's a psychological cancer. It's a political cancer. It's a social cancer. And it has damaged our republic for hundreds of years, and we need to excise it. We need to cut this cancer out and move forward with a pluralistic, egalitarian, multiracial society, which we can do.
Well, if it doesn't happen, Tom, the United States, which is a very young as nations go, will not survive. It's continued to be the cancer that you talked about. And you spoke just a few moments ago about the connection between law enforcement, and you and I both know this history intimately, and slave patrols. And that is a nexus to what happened to January 6th. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Kenya. Good talking with you as always. And I'll keep following you over on Medium and Medium.com and Op-Ed News. Thank you. It's the True People's Media. Stick around. We'll be right back.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
We're going to do a deep dive. This is just an extraordinary book. This new book, 400 Souls, edited by Ibram Kendi and Keisha Blaine. And Keisha Blaine is with us. Dr. Keisha Blaine is a historian and associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, the president of African American Intellectual History Society, co-editor of this new book, 400 Souls, that I just told you about, also the author of Set the World on Fire, Black Nationalist Women in the Global Struggle for Freedom, and the forthcoming Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Vision of America. Keisha Blaine, KeishaBlain.com is her website. Dr. Blaine, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to, if we can, just kind of chronologically go through the history of America as characterized in your book. If you want to give us a quick summary of pulling the book together. First of all, you have many different authors and a lot of different content in it, and it is organized chronologically. If you wanted to give us just a summary of that, and then let's just jump into the early 1600s.
Sure. So the book begins in 1619, and as we explain in the introduction and even in several of the chapters, 1619 is a critical year because that's the year a group of captive Africans arrived in Jamestown, Virginia, and the book then essentially charts the development of slavery leading to emancipation. Jim Crow will certainly talk about various periods in more depth, but then it ends in 2019, the 400 year mark. So it is a sweeping history. We cover 400 years, but in many ways we also connect to a number of core themes that relate to American life and culture that extend to the present day.
So let's do a little deeper dive into some of these. In 1630, there was a Virginia court ruling. In fact, perhaps to put this in context, the reading that I've been doing in the last year or so has been informing me that whiteness, essentially, being defined not by whiteness so much as by defining limitations on people who are not white, was largely the invention of the Virginians, of white people in Virginia, throughout the 1600s. And by the early 1700s, it was fairly well established, both at law and at culture. Would you agree with that? And how does this 1630 Virginia court ruling that ordered the whipping of Hugh Davis play into all that?
Yes, I certainly do agree. And in fact, I think what's clear throughout the entire text, even as we think about race in general, we're able to see, you know, we often emphasize that race is a social construct, but I think even more so we see that it's a historical construct as well. And you're referring to just a brilliant essay by Ijeoma Oluo, which examines this case where a white man was essentially whipped for sleeping with a black woman. And as you point out, even in this moment, and this is very early in the first section of the book, 17th century, it's clear that there are ideas about what is accepted and what is not accepted. And what is also clear is that blackness is certainly attached, even in these early years, to the development of slavery, but even more so to scorn, to ideas of shame. And therefore, when a white man in this instance ends up having relations with a black woman, he faces this public act of embarrassment because it's meant to send a message, this is something that you simply do not do. And we see, as we move throughout the history, how these ideas remain salient. And of course, there's a constant struggle throughout the history as it relates to even interracial unions. We know this, of course, even through the context of Loving versus Virginia. So it's critical that we talk about Virginia in the 17th century, and then we end up talking about race in a later context with that court case in the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, so much of our law, so much of our history came out of Virginia. The Virginians kind of drove the process. Jefferson, Washington, Madison drove the process of creating this country. Well, and we're all slaveholders, of course, and we're the heirs of this invention, as it were. I understand that it really wasn't until the mid-1600s that Virginian law in particular is kind of setting the way for the rest of the law across the United States, shifted from being bonded, people being in bondage, basically in debt, to chattel slavery, to the invention of just a person being outright owned and their children are owned and period, full stop, it's always going to be this way, world without end, amen, that some or many of the people from Africa who were brought to this country involuntarily initially were bonded for shorter periods than life, and some were bonded for life, but the idea was that their heirs wouldn't be, and that really started falling apart in the mid-1600s. Is my understanding of that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and in fact, there is an essay in the book which I think helps to break this down, and the reality is that this moment, this entire period, you know, when we talk about the colonial era, it is a period, to a large extent, I wouldn't say fluidity, but there's a lot of change taking place. In fact, even as we talk about the first group of captive Africans who arrived in 1619, you know, there is some scholarly debate. I think certainly some people would insist that we have to identify this group as enslaved. Others would say, well, not quite, but you know, some people will say bonded. Some people will say that it wasn't clear what their fate was, that perhaps, you know, they were going to just work for a period of years, as you point out, through a contract, and then they would ultimately be able to do something else or potentially return. The reality is that what's clear is that by the time you do get to the mid-1600s, it is no longer a question as to whether a person who is black in the territory that will become the United States, there's no question at that point whether you would have the ability to live a life of freedom. What is clear by the 1650s is that blackness is completely tied to enslavement, and there are very limited rights and opportunities. And Nikia Parker wrote an essay which she called On Free Labor, and that looks at 1654 to 1659, and it grapples with this moment of change. So you're absolutely right. I think once you get to part two of 400 Souls, it's no longer any murkiness about classifications of black people.
Yeah, and white people were still coming over as bonded laborers right up until the mid-1700s, arguably even into the 1800s. But that avenue was completely closed to anybody who was not, quote, white. Yeah. We'll continue the conversation. We're talking with Dr. Keisha Blaine, the co-author or co-editor of this extraordinary collection, A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019. The book is 400 Souls.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's our Conversations with Great Minds with Dr. Keisha Blaine, historian and associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. So, Dr. Blaine, I'm curious how the concept of privacy might tie into all of this. You know, that was expressed in the Fourth Amendment that people have the right to have basically security in their person, their home, their person, and their effects. And how that altered throughout the 1600s as this concept of whiteness grew and the concept of blackness grew, and or is there a story there to be told?
Well, to some extent, I mean, I think we're still, we still have to think through this, the vein and the lens of slavery. And so even as you read through the narrative in the first part of 400 Souls, it's clear that black people, even in that moment, have very few rights and opportunities. And in the end, what does privacy even look like in a moment where people do not recognize, you know, black Americans? Well, they certainly don't even recognize them as humans. They don't recognize them as people. And they recognize them and they see them as property. So it's hard to even think about this notion of privacy and as some sort of right that applies to all people in this particular moment, given, I think, the reality of slavery as an institution.
What about the issue of just fundamental humanity? I know that reading some of in Jefferson's diaries, there was this kind of pseudoscience of the day that the races were fundamentally biologically different. Where did that come from and how has that changed over the years?
Mm-hmm. So this certainly, I mean, we can draw connections, I think, you know, certainly to the period that you're talking about, but I also think immediately about the Bible, and I think about it as a text that people have used in both directions. One, to try to justify claims that black people are different and therefore not to be treated as equals, and then of course the abolitionists were able to use the same text to make the complete opposite argument, to insist on black people's humanity. And I think immediately about Chris LeBron. Chris LeBron wrote a piece in 400 Souls on the Germantown petition against slavery, which centers the role of the Quakers in particular. And one of the arguments that they make in that petition is the fact that that we have to think about humanity and that black people are humans. And part of the challenge to slavery as an institution is the fact that it doesn't take into account their humanity. So these ideas are absolutely salient in the history, and I think of the Germantown petition in particular in the second section as an example of that.
Remarkable stuff. We'll be right back. We're talking with Dr. Keisha Blaine, historian, associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, and the co-author of this brilliant new book, 400 Souls, or the co-editor, I guess, A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Keisha Blaine, the co-author of 400 Souls, this brilliant new anthology collection of writings. Dr. Blaine, Heather McGee wrote an extraordinary piece on Bacon's Rebellion. It marked a bit of a turning point. Was that a turning point?
I think a number of key developments bring into the narrative developments, such as the Bacon's Rebellion, which I think is not as widely known. And for us, Heather McGee, of course, just a brilliant writer, one of the things that she attempted to do was get us to start thinking through the various ways that people oftentimes did come together to ally their interests, oftentimes did come together collectively to challenge slavery as an institution, and also to attempt, I think, to create a better space in which Black people, certainly, but not only Black people, I think other marginalized groups could have a space to assert their rights and autonomy. And I think her discussion of Bacon's Rebellion is critical. And we had her write about this from the period of 1674 to 1679, which again is still very early in the history, way before the American Revolution, and yet I think an important moment in understanding how these ideas of certainly resistance, but to an extent of solidarity, are critical to the understanding the history.
You also have a piece by Sylvia Dioff, am I saying that right, about the Maroon communities, 1719 to 1724.
Yes.
Please explain, Maroon.
Yeah, so these were individuals enslaved individuals who decided to escape and essentially to live on the run, to hide out in order to maintain some level of autonomy. And so constantly being on the run, which of course meant a very difficult life, and part of why we wanted to include this piece was to get people to understand how enslaved Black people resisted their enslavement, and running away was of course one way to do this. And Maroons in particular not only ran away, but they had to come up with creative ways to even build their own communities, hiding essentially for many years, in order to not be brought back into a system of slavery. And so that essay captures that theme of resistance and to an extent, I think, creativity in the way that people hid themselves in different spaces and places. And it's a story that is central to the context of U.S. history, but also tied, I think, to a larger diasporic history.
Yeah. If I could just go back to Bacon's Rebellion real quickly, and I apologize, I haven't read Heather McGee's essay in the book. We just got the book yesterday. But my recollection of reading this years ago about Bacon's Rebellion was that was the moment in time when poor whites joined with some freed and many not free Blacks and engaged in rebellion. And that was kind of the point when the fathers of Virginia, as it were, said, holy cow, we've got to figure out a way to get poor whites to align themselves with rich whites rather than with equally poor Blacks. Is that kind of an accurate recollection of that? And was that a turning point?
Yes, in broad strokes. I mean, I think what is key about Heather McGee's piece, she comes at it, I think, through a different angle. She certainly is framing it, as you pointed out, the fear that mm-hmm. Bacon's Rebellion incited in white slaveholders and the way that people began to think about race. I mean, we were talking about race earlier in the earlier period and trying to avoid a situation, essentially trying to avoid a repeat whereby, poor whites would potentially ally themselves with people of African descent and overturn the entire system. So it was a turning point. I think you can frame it as such, not only for Virginia, but I would say even just thinking about it in a broader scope, it was a turning point on a national level, even though, again, this is still an earlier period, a moment of formation long before the American Revolution.
Yeah, you could say that that was the moment or one of the moments when race and class diverged substantially.
Yes, I think so. And what Heather, I think, tried to do in that piece, which, of course, all the pieces in 400 Souls do, is get us to think not only about the historical context, but also how that connects to the present. And I can think about this even in recent months as we witness the uprisings across the nation, across the globe. There's so many moments that you can talk about as watershed moments where we have to, where we see how people come together, certainly along the lines of race, but also along the lines of class, and generally how marginalized groups figure out ways to ally in order to challenge systems of oppression.
Yeah, it's just an absolutely remarkable, what I have been able to read in the book has been fascinating, and I'm looking forward to spending a lot more time with it. We will continue our conversation. We'll jump into the 18th and 19th and 20th centuries here in the last half hour of our conversation with Dr. Keisha Blaine, historian and associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, president of the African American Intellectual History Society, and the co-editor with Ibram Kendi of this new book, 400 Souls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The book is 400 Souls, a community history of African America, 1619 to 2019. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Keisha Blaine, historian, associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, president of the African American Intellectual History Society, co-editor with Ibram Kendi of the new book, 400 Souls. And Dr. Blaine, moving along into the 1800s here, could you tell us about Jamel, is it Bowie, wrote a piece about black soldiers mm-hmm. and veterans in the Civil War and the mobilization of freed people?
Yes. So we asked Jamil Bowie to write on the Civil War. And as I said earlier, it was important for us to certainly highlight key moments in this history. And there was no way we could write a book on U.S. history without grappling with the Civil War. What's important about this particular essay is the point of view that it takes. And here what it does is that it centers black soldiers in particular, their service in the war, and part of why we wanted Jamil Bowie to write this piece was to send a message about the way that black people essentially viewed the war as a window of opportunity to seize their freedom. So it wasn't about waiting for someone to set them free. We certainly can talk about key developments in the war period that aided black people's efforts. And we know this, you know, through, for example, the Emancipation Proclamation, which made it possible for black military service to begin with. But this piece is about seeing the ways that Black people asserted themselves and saw this moment as a chance to essentially make sure that their lives would be improved and that they would not have to return ever to a system of slavery.
And this was, across the country. Let's talk for a moment about the Emancipation Proclamation. I think mm-hmm. that it's widely misunderstood. I mean, 50, 60 years ago when I was in elementary school, we learned that Lincoln freed the slaves. It wasn't right. anything close to that simple.
Exactly. You know, I tell my students all the time, this is certainly an important development in the history, so I'm not suggesting that it's not an important development, but I think perhaps the most important contribution of the Emancipation Proclamation is the fact that it made it possible for Black people to serve in the U.S. military. It certainly did send a message overall about the centrality of slavery when it came to the Civil War, because, of course, the rhetoric then and even now, to a large extent, there are still people who will frame it as simply a war for states' rights, and some people resist the notion that slavery had anything to do with it. But as we know, it's all deeply connected and intertwined. And so the Emancipation Proclamation ultimately was limited because it was a proclamation that, one, certainly did not apply to those who were enslaved who lived in border states. That's significant, but also it ultimately, covered those who lived in rebel territory, so it could not, be fully enforced. But what is key is that it opened up an opportunity for Black people to fight in the military, and Jamil Bowie centers those voices and experiences, and I think that part of the history was important to tell in 400 Souls.
Yeah, and it's done brilliantly. To this larger point, kind of a personal question, I grew up in the North and lived in the North until I was in my 30s, and then we moved to Atlanta. We lived in that area for about 13 years. And I remember when my son came home from school, he must have been 8 or 9 years old, maybe 10 years old, and I said, "What'd you learn in school today?" And he said, "Oh, we're studying the War of Northern Aggression," and which just blew my mind. And I'm wondering, it's been that was in the 1980s. That was in the early 1980s. Mm-hmm. Is it still that bad? I mean, is the teaching of American history that calcified, that rigidified by 400 years of white supremacy and control over history?
Well, I think it absolutely depends on where you live, where you attend school. One of the things that's clear is that, for example, Texas comes to mind as a state where there is still to this very day a battle over how educators can talk about the Civil War and or even slavery in general. There are still textbooks that do not fully explain the horrors of slavery. Tries to talk about it in a way that's "quote unquote fair and balanced." Well, there's no balanced assessment of slavery. It was a terrible institution, and it was wrong. And there's still battles taking place. I think depending on various states are debating these concerns. So there's still progress. I would hope it's not as bad as the example you give in the 1980s. But this does not mean that we're at a place where students are fully grasping this history, and I think to this very day you can meet people who will resist the notion that for example that the Civil War has anything to do with slavery because of the way that they were taught in high school and even in some colleges too.
Tell me about the Great Migration. Isabel Wilkerson writing about this in your book 400 Souls. We're talking with Dr. Keisha Blaine.
Yeah, so of course, I think it's impossible to even study the Great Migration without engaging the work of Isabel Wilkerson. So she was the first person that we thought of to write this piece. And what we wanted to do in a similar fashion, I think it's clear the theme of Black agency runs through the text. And this chapter, in a similar way, helps people see how Black people came together in mass to resist a system of, in this particular case, a system of Jim Crow segregation and violence and terror and collectively resist by moving, by exploring opportunities outside of the South and bringing their families, working together through networks and institutions to try to make a better life for themselves. So in a similar way, if you look at the piece on the Civil War and you look at the piece of the Great Migration, what you see is Black autonomy, decisions being made at an individual level, but even a collective vision that is connected to a vision of seeking rights and liberation at a moment where there's so much violence and so much resistance and white backlash, which we certainly see throughout the history.
What is the lingering echo of that? You know, occasionally it gets referenced in the context of, you know, large Black populations in Detroit or in Philadelphia, things like that. Is that the principal echo, or are there others?
Well, I think it's more so just a constant struggle among Black communities, and I think even the constant struggle among Black people to try to figure out how to improve their social conditions. And so, the piece by Isabel Wilkerson is looking at the Great Migration and focuses specifically on a movement primarily from South to North and also to West, to the West. But there are other narratives, too, that even think beyond U.S. borders. And here we think about immigrationist movements, and you have, you know, African-Americans historically, but even to this very day, who decide, you know, we are tired of the racism, we're tired of the violence, the oppression, and we want to explore, you know, new lands and new opportunities beyond U.S. borders to try to improve our conditions. So you see these, I think, recurring themes, even in the current day. Even the last 4 years, there were many people who said, well, you know, maybe the answer is simply to leave if we're not going to see things improve on U.S. soil.
Is it your sense that things are improving now, post-Trump?
Right. A bit. I think there's a lot left to do, but I think we are moving in the right direction.
Yeah, one hopes. I mean, I just don't see how anybody can call Trumpism anything other than just naked white supremacy, you know, openly, blatantly, aggressively, proudly, as in the Proud Boys and that kind of thing, sadly. We're talking with Dr. Keisha Blaine, the historian and associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, and most consequentially, in the context of this conversation, the co-editor of this book, 400 Souls, A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Dr. Blaine, I have been kind of leading this conversation by asking you about parts of the book that piqued my curiosity. I'm curious, what part of the book do you feel the most excited, enthusiastic about, or would most like to share with people?
Well, there's an essay in the book written by a philosopher by the name of Catherine Sophia Bell. She's a professor at Penn State, and it's an essay on Mariah Stewart, who was an abolitionist and a feminist, ultimately from the city of Boston, living there in the 1830s. And I particularly love that piece because it helps us see the connections between past and present, and particularly, I think, just the power of Black women's leadership. One can draw the connections between Mariah Stewart and the work of the courageous Black women who established Black Lives Matter, for example. And so that piece resonates with me. And just like I said, it captures Black women's political leadership. We've seen that, of course, even in electoral politics over the last couple of months. We've seen the critical role of Black women in Georgia and other places, making it possible for us to experience, I think, significant changes on a national level. So that's a piece that I love and hope people will find much, I think, inspiration as they read it.
Is there a particular story in there that you could tell?
I will simply say that what's powerful is Mariah Stewart stood up in Boston before mixed audiences of, you know, white and black people to demand black rights and political autonomy at a moment where millions of black people were still enslaved, primarily in the U.S. South. And so that was a bold move. It was a courageous move, and it was a dangerous move. But it spoke to her courage and her passion, and I think we certainly can find inspiration in that story.
Yeah, and we so need our stories. I mean, you know, it's stories are the underpinning of culture. And we have a great collection of them here in 400 Souls, edited by Ibram Kendi and Dr. Keisha N. Blaine. We'll be back in just a moment. I want to get up to the 20th century here. Would you like to add to that story, or is there another story you'd like to share with us in this last minute?
Well, I think another piece that I would highlight is a piece by Tara Hunter on the city of Atlanta, and this is a piece that looks at 1874 to 1879. And again, what's key in this essay is just centering black women, the way that working class black women came together in the city to really build community and to establish themselves in the aftermath of the Civil War. I think one can find similarly, you know, hope and inspiration in these narratives, individuals who had very little, but still had a vision, bold visions, and worked toward that within their communities and, you know, within institutions, including churches and clubs. And so it just, I think it's the kind of story that that resonates with us today.
Stories of bravery and resilience and extraordinary inspiration. We'll be right back with Dr. Keisha Blaine, historian and associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, president of the African American Intellectual History Society, co-editor with Ibram Kendi of the new book, 400 Souls, A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019. Speaking with Dr. Keisha N. Blaine, the co-editor of A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019, titled 400 Souls. Dr. Blaine, to bring us closer to the present moment, certainly the last few decades, Angela Davis wrote about the devastation caused by the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act. Talk about that and how things have changed and not changed from basically the 80s, the so-called Reagan Revolution, to this moment.
Yes, and so I think this piece, just, you know, similar to so many others, help us see how we got to this particular moment. We see the ways that the black people have been criminalized, and black and brown people in particular, have been criminalized in U.S. society, and you're asking what has changed. Well, a lot has not changed, and we see that particularly because over the last couple of months, with the uprisings and the constant struggle, the constant challenge of dealing with police violence and brutality, what happens every time there is a case that makes it to the national level, whether we're talking about George Floyd most recently, is that, you know, black people enter, you know, in every space, in public spaces, even in private spaces, or criminalized. And it leads to these encounters, which, as we know, are deadly. So a lot has not changed. And I think that's part of what 400 Souls captures is, yes, we can talk about progress, but we can also talk about the continued struggles in society and anti-black racism, state-sanctioned violence, these are challenges that remain persistent to this very day. And so the story that Davis unfolds helps set the stage, I think, in many ways for where we are today.
What was the genesis of this legislation, the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act? How did this come about? I mean, this is the one that, if I'm recalling correctly, this is the bill that Joe Biden is apologizing for his role in.
Well, as a historian, I would argue that the origins actually go back pretty far, and it goes to the period of slavery. And I think I always remind my students that when you when you think about even the criminalization of black people, or if you think about police violence, for example, it's not solely a 20th century story, you know, or even a 19th century story. It's one that comes directly from the history of slavery and all of these patrols and that were established in the aftermath of the Civil War that attempted to control black people's lives and their movements. And so when you have a movement, when you have an institution, rather, that comes out of that history, it's therefore not surprising that you would have all of these developments, even later into the 20th century, that seek to further criminalize black people. And so, yes, one can talk about Joe Biden's role, certainly, but I want to think about it even in a broader and a longer sense throughout history, in the way that we have been creating a society that criminalizes some groups and ultimately empowers police forces to continue this, you know, devastating string of police killings and so on. So I think one can think of it through that lens.
Yeah, particularly the police in the South, in many cases, just coming straight out of the old slave patrols. Where do we go forward? What are the things that are giving you hope as you're looking out at America's political landscape right now? I mean, in the House, we had Republicans basically trying to blame the January 6th problem on Black Lives Matter. I mean, literally blaming it on Black Lives Matter. This is not going away.
Right. Unfortunately, you know, I think I'm hopeful because, you know, as you mentioned earlier, certainly for me, it's meaningful that we no longer have Donald Trump in office. And certainly, I'm not suggesting that, you know, within the administration that everything is perfect and all of a sudden we can celebrate and go on our merry way. We still have a ton of work to do, but it's meaningful when there are people in office who at least espouse a commitment, at least, you know, they articulate a commitment to building an inclusive democracy. The key is going beyond, you know, words and expressions and stated commitments to actual, you know, policies. So part of what we have to do, I think all of us as American citizens, we have to continue to push and demand that promises are kept. But it's a hopeful time to have people in office who are not trying to agitate further and encourage white supremacists.
There you go. Dr. Keisha Blaine, thank you so much for dropping by today. It's been fascinating speaking with you, and it's an extraordinary book. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. 400 Souls, edited by Keisha Blaine and Ibram Kendi, subtitle A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019. Check it out. We'll be back same time, same place. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you to be active. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.